This podcast is a part of the Gunna Geek Network. The opinions expressed may not reflect those of other podcasts or affiliates of this show or Gunna Geek. Check out other geeky podcasts at GunnaGeekNetwork.com. Get ready, because the geekiness commences in 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, a podcast dedicated to everything Doctor Who. Join us each week for discussion ranging from Hartnell to Capaldi. I'm your host, Jay Witten. Did you just say womp womp? And my co-host, Haley Malley.
I like it with the helmet on.
And Keir Hansen.
And that's why, to this day, I can't eat cotton candy.
Spoilers.
We will be discussing news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired. But don't worry, if we get into anything too serious, we'll warn you again. Welcome to episode 170 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where we, as responsible, well-meaning adults, follow a teenage girl home in the least stalkery way we can manage, only to have her grouchy grandfather overreact and start behaving like it's the freaking Stone Age or something. Some people just can't understand genuine concern for a student's well-being. I am Jay, and with me in the studio tonight is the man who smashes the rocks together, Keir. How are you doing tonight, Keir?
I am leader!
And the requisite females in the crew, her. Haley, how are you doing tonight?
Her like fire.
Her.
Well, this week we are preparing for the long, cold season of a Doctor Who hiatus by rewatching the show. No. Not just the recent show as we know it. We're going back into time. All the way back to the story that started it all. Join us, won't you, as we set the controls for 1963 and discuss An Unearthly Child.
Well, this was certainly a change of pace. It was slightly different.
And they think Capaldi is prickly.
Oh yeah. Well, okay. Well, yeah. We'll definitely get to that. But it's fascinating now. You know, every time I go back and I start watching season one, I get all of these. Obviously, you get to revel in all of the nostalgia of the building blocks of where a lot of these things began and where they first started floating some of the ideas that now are just, you know, it's the construct on which we're built. But at the time, they were just feeling these things out. So, but what I really enjoy is watching Hartnell, knowing now from the biopic and all the interviews and the opportunities to speak with his cast members from the time and understand everything that he was putting into it, what a consummate professional he was. Mm-hmm. You know, we look at it after, you know, literally over a dozen individuals have played the role, and you have to remind yourself that he's doing this completely off the cuff, so to speak.
He's not building off anything that anyone else had brought to the role.
Right, yeah. He had no idea what the previous doctors had done.
He was just an actor that was given a role and decided to play it.
Yeah, so.
What a crazy concept.
Where do you want to, do we want to go through this episode by episode, or do we want to just sort of lump it together and sort of react in total?
I say we go through, like, story-wise, but...
Okay.
The entire first episode is nothing more than a character introduction. I mean, that's all we get, is we get to meet Ian and Barbara, we get to meet Susan, and eventually we get to meet the Doctor, and that's about all that happens.
Well, one of my predominant notes from the first story, the title story, Unearthly Child, is the fact that it's a huge commentary on the nature of the fantastic just being unable to be accepted by the logic of the assumed to be intelligent representatives of the current time. Mm. And I enjoy it. It's something that carries over into the second episode as well. But it's boiled down here in the arguments that they're having in the Foreman scrapyard, mm-hmm. You know. And then once they first step inside the TARDIS and have to take in the unbelievability of it, and the argument that goes on back and forth between Ian and the Doctor, about, you know, about accepting it versus, you know, being open-minded about it versus just being ridiculously simple-minded about it. And that's where you get to see Hartnell sort of run this really interesting line between being extremely spiky and cold about it and being just genuinely amused at the simplicity of these 20th century humans.
And that's one of the great things too, is that it doesn't, at first Hartnell seems really spiky. He seems really, you know, really unfriendly and like someone you really don't want to be around for very long. But eventually you get to understand him and you get to know his doctor a little bit, and you see it's not so much that he can't, you know, he doesn't want to be around them. He just, he's operating on such a higher level that most of the time it's frustrating. And then other times he's just laughing at them for being so completely primitive.
Hmm. We don't get a whole lot yet as far as the concerns that are weighing on the doctor and Susan at present, their problems.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we come into it being thrust into Susan having to make the decision to stay or go, and then obviously Barbara and Ian getting thrust into the midst of it all and having to come along for the ride for a series of circumstances that keep them in the TARDIS in stories to follow. But you get just the slightest indication that there are repairs being made, that that Susan chose to be involved with her 20th century surroundings at the time. You know, if I'm stuck here, I might as well wander around and see the scenery a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Against the doctor's advisement, he'd rather just stay completely isolated, get the parts he needs, get the repairs going, and move on. And we only get the slightest hint of the fact that they've been on the run, literally.
Right.
Right. He refers to them as exiles.
Mm. I do really appreciate the way that, at least from the early scenes, you know, we obviously see how the doctor treats the present time, the current time, with this little bit of disdain and slight amusement at its simplicity. But Susan sort of plays a level of frustration with the simplicity of Earth, you know, with her issues with her classes, or the fact that she can't explain everything to the way that she would choose to. She would probably be much more forthcoming if her grandfather did not advise her to, because she probably is under the belief that they wouldn't comprehend it anyway, so she could probably just tell them anything and either they'll accept it or not, and it's not going to be a concern. She'd rather be open and honest about it.
Right.
And I do really like the way that she plays that frustration level.
Yeah, that's one thing that, going back and having spoken to Carol Ann Ford and heard her in interviews and things like that, you understand the depth that she put into this character, regardless of what was on the script and what made it to the screen. Is she had this character thought out like far beyond anything you would have imagined.
Mm. And from what she had divulged with us, a lot of that was in following, she says, Bill's lead, William Hartnell's lead, because he had everything determined. You know, he would scrutinize the scripts, he would scrutinize the set, he wanted the console to be as practical as possible so that he could always know that if he was going to be closing the doors, he always reached for this lever. If he was going to be setting time controls, he was going to be going for these buttons. If he's going to be referring to equipment somewhere around the console room, he's going to gesture off in a certain direction and send her off to the same location. So that, I think, is probably an infectious degree of professionalism and investment in the character that I think a lot of the rest of the cast picked up on.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, that's when somebody has that kind of commitment, it's you. I mean, one, you don't want to mess up their flow, so you kind of go along with what they're doing, and then that you have to develop your own little things to go along with it. It's just part of the trade.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah, I love the chemistry between Ian and Barbara. Absolutely love it. And I love the fact that they played it as close as they did without having it to be. I mean, it was very indicative of the time in terms of what, you know, coworkers, especially in an educational environment with a male female relationship kind of thing, without being necessarily anything romantic of that sort, but they're very close,
right?
You know, and concerned for one another, comforting one another when necessary, calming one another when necessary. But when they're in good spirits and things, and they're riffing with each other, Ian's character is absolutely delightful. He's just the most affable guy on the planet.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, that was intentional. You had the doctor who was, you know, who was very spiky, who was alien, And so you needed someone, you needed that male lead to be the person that people could associate with and get along with and look up to and, you know, aspire to be kind of thing. So Ed, he was a very good counterpoint to Hartnell's Doctor.
Well, that's actually an excellent point that I wanted to bring as we get into the second episode of the story for Cave of Skulls. Mm-hmm. So at that point, by the time we come into this, they're having the argument within the TARDIS interior about whether or not they've actually traveled.
Right.
And it goes on for a good amount of time. And you think to yourself, well, that's interesting. Why don't you just open the door and we end this? You know, just answer the question, spill them out there, let them play around with some Paleolithic rocks for a minute or two, and it's problem solved. But I'm glad that that dialogue exists, because what it ends up doing is taking Ian as the representative of the doubts and incredulousness of the of what was probably a good chunk of the viewing audience at the time, who were looking at a show like this saying, this is a bunch of baloney. How am I supposed to, I can't believe any of these things. It's all ridiculous. He's traveling through time in a box for crying out loud. And, you know, and it just seems he sort of takes that side of what could potentially be a critical audience. And then you've got Barbara, who sort of serves as the other half of the audience who aren't really prepared for this sort of thing, but she's more open-minded and prepared to at least weigh it out and see its validity. Mm-hmm. So that's where a two-companion dynamic actually does a great job of representing the audience at a time when the audience is potentially split. So really glad that that's there.
What, the Whovian audience split? That doesn't happen. No. We're always of one mind. We agree on everything.
I'm just saying we're never of one mind. We never agree. That's what I'm saying. You know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Haley is Switzerland.
Have you seen the unaired pilot version of the episode?
Yes.
Okay. I have not. Enlighten me.
It's a much more hostile Doctor.
Mm. Very much so.
That little scuffle outside of the TARDIS when Ian's trying to get in goes on a little more.
Okay.
Yeah, the physicality that is indicative of the third and fourth episodes within the story stays throughout. And I think a lot of that was because they wanted it to really be kind of more of a high action involvement, as much as it had the fantastical and the historical and all the key points that they wanted to hit for the program itself. They knew that they were going to have to keep it moving as much as possible. So this is something where arguments were bigger arguments, grappling was near wrestling, you know, and a lot of that remained within the stories to follow. But in the unaired pilot, it was there from the get-go. Like almost a takedown. but no, we'll make sure that you get a chance to check that out, Jay. I think from Construct, especially going into, you know, what actually did air as the first episode kind of confuses the audience a little bit. They're not really prepared for what they're about to see. They tune in the next week to see or to try and see the validity of what they just witnessed, or maybe grab some other people to say, you got to see this for a second. I'm not really sure what I make of this. And how else are you going to sell a change through time than to jump 100,000 years BC?
Right. Right back to the beginning of time.
No, it's 1962 now. Whoa, okay, just everything's different. But no, jump big.
and that was a great way to kind of showcase what they were trying to do with the show, where we've talked about this before, how the whole concept of the show, you know, you had Barbara, who was there as the history teacher to, you know, kind of teach kids history through this show, and Ian was there as a science teacher to, you know, and so that's why they did a lot of, you know, that's why the whole time travel dynamic came about, was because, well, you can go to history and teach kids history, and we can jump to the future and teach them science. And they kind of had the ability to do that with this story. You know, you've got the history in place, which is all, you know, broad strokes, we'll say. Mm-hmm. And then you had, you know, you give Ian the chance to be like, well, this is basic fundamental science at work here. This is how you make fire. You know, this is, and, you know, so it was able to showcase what they were trying to do with the show. So jumping back to that time period made a lot of sense, not just for the narrative, but for what the direction was at the time.
And it keeps the sets and costumes dirt cheap. Well, that was a genuine concern at the time. Mm-hmm. You know, they had to make sure that they could pull this off without blowing the budget out.
Because they had very little budget.
Yeah. I will say this, and we started kind of referencing this before we started tonight, but I was impressed and I'm pleased at the fact that they did not go into what we now consider to be stereotypical caveman speak.
Right, the oog, og.
Yeah,
you go here.
They left their proper pronouns in. They didn't use quite as many definite articles and such, but they were there, you know.
But we had to know they were cavemen.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, you had your naming convention.
Old woman.
Or, well, the old woman, I love the crone. I absolutely love her.
Sorry.
You know, the fact that you didn't know for the longest time what she was so angry about. She'd just stare off into the distance, spewing this, all will go one well. We will all die here. There will be no fire, no leader, and we will all die. And no one's paying any attention to her. Just, oh, gosh, she's going off on it again. Okay.
Sorry, anytime they refer to her as old woman, I keep wanting her to react by saying, I'm 37.
Did you see how short her skirt was?
Well, you know, she was progressive for her time. But man, she had one heck of an axe to grind with whatever she was upset about, which we find out a little later. You know, Orb has not treated her well. But no, I mean, without going into the caveman speak and such, it keeps it from being too comedic. Because if I think they went too far into the, you know, me good, you bad, thump chest, it'd be difficult to let the story have any sort of weight to it other than here's four intelligent people surrounded by complete nitwits. Mm-hmm. They just need to find an escape plan and everything's going to be good. But because they had a little bit more of a cohesive ability to communicate and what they were doing, there was a power struggle, which we could understand. They were very politician-like. I don't trust anybody in this tribe. All their leaders were complete liars.
Yeah. But, see, it's the oldest game in the book.
But it made it easier to get kind of to follow that story along without just waiting for them. God, when are they just going to stop talking to the cavemen? Cut back to the Cave of Skulls so we can find out what's going on with the four. Mm. You know,
it gave them it made the cavemen a credible threat. If they were just, you know, monkeys with the ability to speak, then it wouldn't seem like it was that big a threat. I mean, here you have four modern age intelligent people, you know, two of which are arguably far more superior to the teachers. So it's like you wouldn't believe that there was a threat to them from these cavemen if that they were just, you know, basically monkeys.
Right.
So giving them the ability to speak properly help to relay that okay, they have thought process, they can rationalize things like this, they can plan, they can plot, there's, you know, they might have a shot at defeating our heroes.
Right.
Even though one of them spent his first 5 minutes on screen rubbing his hands around a bone in the air.
Well, he couldn't remember. There's a lot of steps involved. A lot of steps. And if you weren't really paying attention at the time, you know, he was kind of checking out some cave drawings over on the side or, you know,
get together with her.
Yeah, see if her was paying attention to him at the time. But she's opportunistic. She was just going after the leader. That's all right. Looking out for number one. Well,
typical woman.
So
things
we get
change.
To Forest of Fear in the third episode. And at this point, we're starting to recognize that they're going to be doing a bit of a shift with every installment that's provided. There's going to be a different emphasis, sometimes driven by the location or sometimes driven by where the conflict has progressed. So at this point, they have the opportunity to escape through this hole in the back of the cave that no one noticed up to this time.
What a crazy random happenstance.
Who didn't check all the exits? But I love the fact you talk about some of the little things. I love some of the quaintness of the way they put some of these together. So we're watching this, and I'm seeing the, you know, the puppy pile of cavemen all sleeping around in the first scene, and like half of them, the soles of their feet are clean, and the other, and I'm looking over them all, and I'm like, there's not a single one snoring, not one. They're the quietest proto humans.
Well, because, you know, the snoring cavemen got picked off by bears and weren't able to pass along their genes.
That's got to be it. That was natural selection. So none of us these days should be snoring because all of our prehistoric snoring ancestors.
Nah, we learned how to build walls.
Oh, protected ourselves so we could go back to our preferred snoring. There is there's a bit of a drop in pace, I think, in
a little
this
bit.
Particular episode. And a lot of time spent taking apart the inner conflicts within the power struggle of this tribe. So this is probably, I would say, out of the four, this is the challenge episode of the story. But it does have a really good statement through it. When they, there's a theme through it that has to do with the value of fear. And they have a conversation to that effect where they're talking about the fact that, you know, and I'm paraphrasing a bit here, that there is a, it's a sensible and a valuable emotion to feel fear because of how it drives you, as long as it's paired with, or it is at its most effective when it's paired with the emotion that, that Barbara references being hope. And as long as you have that sense of hope, you can go ahead and be afraid because between the two of you, there is something to drive for and you will be compelled to seek it out. So that's sort of their solution path, so to speak.
Yeah. And I mean, it's kind of necessary for the overall narrative of these four episodes. But yeah, this one was rough to get through. This is the one that it's like, okay, I really need to watch this episode. I'm going to put it on my iPad while I'm cooking dinner and I'm going to pay attention to it, kind of.
Sort of.
And so it is problematic, but you know, it is something that had to happen for the narrative. It just, you always have that point where it's like, okay, things slow down so that we can explain things and, you know, make the stupid people understand what's going on.
Mm. But it also gave an opportunity for us to see, as you were saying about keeping the cavemen to be a viable threat, you had to understand that they are conniving to a certain degree. And the ones that are going through the power struggle back and forth. And it wasn't just a matter of a power struggle between Za and Cal. But there was more to it. There was a history to these tribes. There were tribes, there was the question as to whether or not there were tribes over the mountain and things of that sort. So the distrust among them is what keeps them formidable, because it's not just a matter of strictly physical reaction all the time. Our fair traveling quartet could have been killed a dozen times over, but because of the fact that they were being utilized at one point, whether they could create fire at another point, because they could be used to frame somebody else,
mm-hmm.
you know, it definitely adds quite a bit. And you do get a lot of that established, or at least it's reiterated within this episode and teed up for what happens within episode four when we get to the real fisticuffs.
Yes, the 8 minutes of caveman fight, climactic battle. Ugh.
Hey, but I love when episode four, when the firemaker starts off and the doctor's got his plan to just kind of go along, you know, follow my lead on this. You know, oh, his first thing is we want him out of the village. Just get rid of him. And they
throw
start
a rock at
stoning him. Follow my lead. Stone that guy. Yeah, neither cruel nor cowardly. That's our doctor.
Yeah, that was one of those things. I was like, oh, that kind of went dark real quick.
It's a good thing he had his running feet on. Yeah, at this point, this was the episode that really made it clear that every single one of the potential tribal leaders was the most backstabbing, self-serving, say anything to get your position of power. Neither one of these guys had merit, nor did her's dad, right? Who I kept calling Will Ferrell. he looked like Will Ferrell from the Don't Fear the Reaper scene.
Yeah.
With the beard and the curly hair. But it gets us to our action fight sequence.
Yeah.
Which is classic.
A month in the making of, slightly sped up, heavily choreographed.
Yeah, but it was only slight, and that's just the thing, and I don't know if it was because, you know, working with the multi-camera system that they were filming with, you know, and because you could tell that for all of the scenes from that particular sequence, it was shot with this kind of an overhead angle down on their fight pit,
mm-hmm.
you know, their MMA pit, and those were the scenes that looked like either, I don't know, maybe that camera was filming at a slightly different rate, or playback wasn't quite synced, because with the torches that were around the ring, the flames were licking just a little too fast.
Yeah.
And they were, you know, they'd fall in the sand and the sand would fall just a little too fast. But I loved it. I loved the fact that it went on for as long as it did, too, because you think to yourself, these guys aren't the most, you know, they're not skilled warriors here. They're accustomed to just bashing things with a fallen over tree. So their fights are going to be sloppy.
I don't know. I mean, I still think that it was it was an intentional choice to, you know, because it, I mean, it is heavily choreographed. Let's say stage combat has come a very long way since the 60s. And this, you know, speeding it up just a little bit was enough to make it look like it was actually happening and wasn't a careful dance.
Right. And they correct a lot of that, you know, even by the time we get to, you know, to Zoe and Jamie with the second doctor, and Zoe tumbling and flipping around, and Jamie, you know, hip checking and throwing people over his shoulder and such. At that point, you've established that this is a show that's going to have an action component to it. So they start really incorporating that into the actors' training, into the use of stunt doubles, and in terms of what they're writing into the script as well. So that's when it's really got its legs under it. But at this point, how many years are you before Pung Far? And we're still, you know, and we're still using those scenes to this day. Two guys squaring off and just slugging it until, you know, one of them gets his head bashed in with a rock. So
we were just missing the epic fight music.
Well, we had bongos in this.
Yeah, it wasn't the same, though.
Provide your own.
I did.
At this point, was fight choreographer even a thing that existed?
No. Well, probably not. There was an individual who served that purpose, but it wasn't a job title, no. Yeah, it was part of the stunt team, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. For as cheesy and dated as it was, it was a great way to top off the episode, to finish off the story. You know, you had all this tension building, and you needed the release at some point. And thank God they didn't go with, like, you know, a Senate town hall meeting kind of, you know, Star Wars prequels solution to the whole thing.
I'm going to teach them all about diplomacy. Yeah. Just build a 30-foot wall to keep the other tribes out. Oh, did I just say that? But I do like, there's a bit of poetic justice to the fact that their actual escape plan that Susan comes up with, you know, the skulls on a torch idea is kind of the, in its simplicity, but in its artistic beauty, because it was fire that was the source of the problem in the first place, and it happens to be their kind of undoing, so to speak. It's like their sci-fi equivalent of, look over there, a blimp. Just run. The entire tribe packs into the Cave of Skulls to look at four burning sticks. Yep. Leaving the door exposed. Brilliant.
Well, yeah, they had the great speech patterns, and, well, we can't expect more than that.
Yeah.
I mean, they are cavemen, after all.
Yeah, we gave you the gift of fluent speech. We can't give you logic and rationale as well. It's a limited supply.
You want to save money on car insurance? Come on. That's too... Mm.
But they knew, I mean, even if you consider this an encapsulated story within the four episodes, that you knew as they were landing, because we've discussed these, the story that follows, the Dalek sequence to follow, that that they were setting us up for what was just going to be an every week, you know, here's the tee up for the next one, here's the tee up for the next one. So we can go ahead and segment the stories as we choose, but they really had the running narrative that they were going to go with for some time.
Yeah, and I mean, it was a function that worked. It was a formula that worked for a long time.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And
now, so in having this, let's see, 22, roughly 88, 89 minutes that we were given for our first set of stories, we've now been handed the starting blocks for what our appreciated universe is to this day. But since we know in retrospect that we don't really have any explanation of Time Lords, regeneration, you know, even the existence of Gallifrey and those things for quite some time, at this point, it's all very, very fluid. And they were going to have to make a lot of these determining factors on their own, you know, as they go, see what works in an episode and what doesn't. And some things do get sort of left to the side, like the rest of the Doctor's family. But some stuff persists. Mm-hmm. So what are some of the fundamentals that you can go back and just appreciate the fact that, wow, that's where it all started?
The doctor's traveling. You know, this is something that's built in from the very beginning that, you know, you cannot get away from. This is something that, you know, we've had from day one, and the fact that he doesn't travel alone. He's got somebody next to him. So, you know, the times that we do have a solo doctor adventure, it's a special thing, and it's disconcerting. You know, it's not something that you can get comfortable with. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm still, to this day, it still bothers me that Susan says that she came up with the acronym TARDIS.
Well, no, listen very carefully. Look at the way that that line is phrased, because it's not, she does not say that she came up with the acronym.
But she's the one that calls it the TARDIS.
Yeah, she refers to it as a word. You know, instead of calling it the TARDIS or calling it the time and relative dimension of space, she just says, I've taken to calling it the TARDIS because that's its name.
Okay.
I think I'll give you the exact line in a second, but it's, I think it, in the careful phrasing, if you want to be really semantic about it,
right?
That's what kind of gives her the out. It's not as if before her, they called it something entirely different.
One thing I have noticed is that Moffat has been kind of careful with that too. Like, and I've seen it in some of the classic episodes where anyone that isn't really associated with the Doctor. I mean, there are exceptions obviously, but most of the time, like other Time Lords and things like that, refer to it as a time capsule.
Yeah, either time capsule or by its model number. It's a type 40, it's a type 70, and so forth.
So that's one of those things that I think Moffat has done to try and alleviate some of that tension. But
So the actual phrasing of the line is, she says, "Well, I made up the name TARDIS from the initials, time and relative dimension in space." So it's, you know, you kind of assume that the full name or maybe even the acronym are written on the original plaque just inside the door. Mm-hmm. And she just started referring to it by a name, just like we'd take something like, you know, SCSI, we call it SCSI, or, you know, REM is RAM. And
right. Yeah. Okay. No, that, okay. I'm okay now.
But I love the fact that with some of the fundamental things that we understand about the TARDIS, I love the fact that when Ian first puts his hand on the thing, he's like, there's a vibration. It's alive. Yes. Yes, it is. And will continue to be for 53 years. As you're mentioning, you know, the fact that his travels are erratic, mm-hmm. because he's not the most adept pilot.
Right. Yeah, I mean, he wasn't trained for this. We learn later on that, you know, he failed his test, but I mean, yeah, he just jumped in this thing and flew off. He didn't know what he was doing. It was just, mm-hmm. Oh, look, a and car with broken. Keys in it.
Yeah. When he first comes back into the TARDIS and he's having this conversation with Susan, you know, he went out to pick up a filament that needed replacing. Or, you know, they do their first, what we see as their first time travel, and they realize, well, there's something wrong. It shouldn't look like a police box anymore. Something must be wrong with the, you know, well, they don't refer to it as a chameleon circuit at the moment. But these are all the things that we now, well, we don't take it for granted, but we take it as gospel. Mm-hmm. And this is where a lot of those things get floated. So, mm-hmm. And he does mention the fact that he and Susan are on the run from their home planet. Right. And that's just enough to give us this weird disconnected aspect that we're going to want to get more from later.
And that's one thing I did notice with these early episodes, especially this story. Like, there's a lot of these things that just get thrown out there as, you know, almost like one-off lines, or just I'm going to put this here. Somebody else can pick it up later and fill it out. I'm not going to bother with all the details. I'm just going to throw something else out. And these things get built upon. And, you know, then you have a writer later on down the road. It's like, oh, wouldn't it be kind of cool if we said that he had two hearts? And now that's a crucial part of the character. And so it's just interesting to see the bare bones that we got in this one.
Mm-hmm. You even take the fact that that point of referring to being cut off from our own planet is only mentioned once. And that is not, and Barbara and Ian don't even question that. Mm-hmm. They're so goggle-eyed by the dimensional shift inside the TARDIS and the whole premise of being able to travel through time and space.
Right, that hearing that these are extraterrestrials is just secondary.
I don't even think it registered. my brain's just going to file that away under the talk about later kind of thing, because I'm still taking in the fact that there are round things all over the inside here.
Yeah.
God, the first console room was gorgeous.
It was.
I mean, for as hokey as, you know, we knew that it was constructed out of, you know, cardboard and Luan plywood and dreams, but just the, you know, the time rotor, just, It was gorgeous.
And I mean, that's the thing too, is it's, I think most of that has to do with nostalgia, because as great as it looks, you go back to 1963, and granted, with what they had at the time, I'm sure that looked fantastic at the time as well, but it's very simplistic. It's just, oh, hey, look, we've got this thing here. Let's, all right, put that there. Look, colander on top of a pot here. Hey, we've got a, you know, a weird instrument. And it was just a lot of, let's use what we have on hand. There wasn't a lot of custom built stuff for this. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was slapped together with duct tape and baling wire, and now it's something that we look upon as, you know, this revered instrument that you get in an episode 52 years later, and you're like, oh, it's so beautiful.
Yeah, it's come all the way around the curve again. Yeah, I would say from a technical aspect, because of the fact that it has that great nostalgia lens on it, which cleans up a lot of ills. You know, time mm-hmm. heals all wounds, and nostalgia covers a lot of cracks in the set. But the only thing I would say out of the entire story where I look at it and go, okay, all right, that's pretty funny, is the final moments within the Firemaker where they're running away from the tribe. And it's just them running in front of a black screen, and someone with a bush every once in a while smacking them on the side of the face, and they're jogging in place to show them running away.
That's great.
Because it just keeps cutting to each one of their faces. So there's Susan, whack, with a fern. And there's Hartnell, whoosh, with a chunk of oak. You know,
It was the live-action equivalent of the Scooby-Doo hallways.
Yes. Yes, the endless hallway that just, wait a minute, we passed that bookshelf before, and again.
But yeah, it's great to go back and visit these old stories, especially the first one. I've watched this one. This is probably one of the first, or the classic stories that I've watched the most, just because it's the first. Yeah, you know, it has a special mm-hmm. place. It's obviously not one of the best stories, but it has that special bit to it.
But you know what? In retrospect, with a lot of the classics that we've rewatched, this is actually a relatively solid story.
Mm-hmm.
The pacing is still kind of being figured out, because they're still sort of, you got to, you know, bear in mind that they're trying to win over an audience that has no idea what they're seeing. But it's not bad.
No,
they've been a lot worse.
Oh yeah, absolutely. But it's, when I think of, like, you know, my favorite stories, or the ones that really stand out to me, this, it takes a while for this one to come up.
Yeah. Okay. I know, you're partial to the Gunslingers.
It's a guilty pleasure. Stop it. We are watching that one. I don't care what you say. And we'll sing along as well. It'll be great with the Skype lag. That's going to be fantastic. Oh, but anyway, so are we ready for the news?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we got a little bit of news this week. The first one, the big news, really, and this has been kind of tossed around a little bit, but it's official now that Stephen Moffat has come out and said that he is actively looking for the next showrunner. So he sees the end of his road. He sees something that, you know, he knows he's going to have to exit at some point, so he's preparing the road at this point.
Yeah. Well, he is established to the point where he understands the fact that there are a lot of projects that he is currently invested in, and I'm sure that with a mind as creative as his, with the resources at his disposal, that he has plans and ideas for a lot of other things that he wants to pursue as well.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just a point where you cannot, regardless of your ability to time travel, you cannot fit more time within your day to try and get to these things. So I think he was very fortunate in the way that he was prepared in his succession of RTD. So I think he probably well recognizes that there is a proper and a graceful way to go about it. And it's just a matter of whether or not he can particularly recognize what is going to be the high note to walk out on.
Yeah.
Or to hand over with, I should say. It's not like he's going to walk out. He's like, just boom, mic drop and storm out.
Deuces.
Yeah. But I mean, as far as I know, a lot of the guesswork is going to begin, and it's already started. There's a lot of people that are starting to pitch to see whether, you know, Chris Chibnall or anybody that has been sort of really invested in some of the writing and production elements of the series so far, so they've sort of tested their mettle, so to speak, or does it completely go outside the box and grab someone that has just barely gotten their feet wet? I even saw Sarah Dollard's name tossed around, which would be an interesting kind of novelty, but I don't know if it's necessarily practical just yet.
No. My biggest fear, and one that's sadly a likely scenario, I swear to God, if Mark Gatiss gets the job, I'm walking.
I don't think he would, though. I honestly don't think so, because he is in a lot of the, as far as having a lot of irons in the fire for other projects as well. Not to mention the fact that he also still continues to want to pursue his acting work. So that's even more of a demand on his time and an erratic schedule.
I'm thinking about the working relationship that Moffat has with him. And that's obviously the first one that comes up is, like, you know, if you're Moffat thinking, okay, who would I be comfortable handing the show over to? Gatiss would probably be one of the first names to pop up.
But it might not necessarily be his decision to make.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, I'm just saying, if that day comes, if that news story ever pops up, I'm walking. Done.
Okay.
Time to go back to Firefly.
I kind of want that to happen just to see what Jay actually does.
Let's just wait until we see the sequel to Sleep No More.
Oh, God.
And it'll turn everything around for you, little buddy.
Yeah, I'm sure. That's what's going to happen there. Yeah.
It's going to blow your mind.
Well, since we know that that for all intents and purposes, Nicholas Briggs would decline the offer if presented, anything else for me is second rate.
Yeah, I'm you know, we just need to keep on dropping that. Like, every time we see him at a convention, we'll just, it's like, so, do you give any more thought to being showrunner? You know, just, eventually it's going to start to sink in. He's going to be like, you know what? Maybe I can do that. And it'll start to seem like his idea too. He's like, you know, I've been giving this a lot of thought.
You gotta ease him into it. Hey, you going to write an episode this season?
We're just going to have to, we'll start out the conversation by handing him our next con ribbon, which is, you know, Briggs for showrunner.
Oh, okay. Well, one person that has been doing some writing, we've got the new show of Class, which we talked about a little bit earlier, you know, being written by Patrick Ness. And apparently this show is going to, it's going to premiere on BBC America.
Yeah. Really surprised by this approach. I don't know if that's whether they believe that this is going to be a little bit more of a critical audience so they can really test it through, or if it has anything to do with the fact that Ness actually being, you know, an American writer, mm-hmm. Or anything of that sort. So it's I think the official word is that, let's see, who did they go? They went to Sarah Barnett, who is a current running or working president of BBCA. And her statement to the press about this, because they are listed as co-producers behind our typical BBC Welsh production team. So she says, with each of these shows, we aim to cut through the noise and provide the innovation and originality that our fans have come to love and celebrate. So we're excited about a fresh twist on the Doctor Who universe, an unconventional take on the crime drama that keeps you guessing at every turn, and an audience, obviously, with the fabulous Adele. So this, I guess they're going to keep this, well, they're keeping a crime drama, so this is going to be procedural, perhaps?
That's the way just it's with, sounding, but...
With a sci-fi bent that just happens to take place at Coal Hill.
Yeah, I don't know. But I'm trying to, like, I've been looking through the article a little bit, and I don't see anywhere where it says that this is a... It doesn't seem like this is a BBC America exclusive. Like, it just... It looks like it's going to premiere on BBC America, but it doesn't say anything about it not airing in the UK. Like, No,
it certainly will air. It's just a matter of, you know, who's going to be getting first airing. Are they actually going to flip this around so that we get it, you know, even with the time offset, we get it, and then the next day it airs in the UK, or some strange twist like that?
Give it to us, and then give it to them like 3 or 4 months later so they can suffer through what we had to with Doctor Who for the first like 5 years.
Yeah, that's a thing we really all suffered through, because there was no other way for us to get the episodes.
Right. We learned our lesson with Sherlock, gosh darn it. Sure we did.
Yeah. Hey, you know what? I love those weekend trips to the UK when shows are airing, okay? Shut up. Because that's exactly how I get my stuff. Yeah, and this the next news article we have, honestly, I don't think that we would talk about it at all, except for the fact that it was so recently that Peter Capaldi said that he wanted David Bowie to be on Doctor Who. And yesterday, unfortunately, in New York, David Bowie passed away due to cancer.
Yeah. I was actually had just been listening to the new album release over the weekend, and I had actually mentioned, you know, a couple episodes prior that, you know, he had the Black Star release coming out that had a very sci-fi feel to the video, and wouldn't it just be really a great element to have, you know, have him make a cameo appearance on the program, because as we know, Capaldi is a massive fan of everything that came out of the proto-punk and late 60s, early 70s, early punk scene going into what became glam rock in the late 70s and early 80s. And it's, he defined a lot of his look around the Thin White Duke. Yeah. So it, for me personally, it was an extremely tough bit of news to take. But I can't imagine the kind of impact that it has on a lot of our creative talent that were in lockstep with his creativity and originality. So I've got a feeling that Peter Capaldi is probably taking this deeply to heart.
Yeah.
Very unfortunate that we never really got the opportunity to involve him. He's always been labeled as a bit of a Time Lord because he's changed his...
He's regenerated himself so much.
Yeah, and redefined himself, yeah, by all means.
I would not be the least bit surprised if we don't get... A glaring homage would be acceptable, but at least a passing, you know, thing from either from Capaldi's doctor himself or just somewhere in the episode, you know, a nod to David Bowie. Something in one of the scripts that, you know, the doctor saying that he's gonna, you know, he's always enjoyed the music or something along those lines. Like,
or if he just came back from a recording session with him or something of that sort.
Yeah.
Yeah, by all means.
Then the last bit of news now is the next Funko Pop that I absolutely have to have on my shelf next to my 12th Doctor and Cyberman, and it's Captain Jack in all his cute Funko Pop glory.
Okay. Well, there are two being released here.
Mm-hmm.
There's just Jack in his usual pose down, and there's Jack in the fuller jacket with the Vortex Manipulator. So you'll have two. They're starting to do the variations now, like they've been doing with, you know, the umpteen Batman and so forth. But what is not mentioned here, I'll make sure that I append it to the news because that I put my order in the other day. Is at least through at this point, you can get on, let's see, as we're recording today, you've got a couple of weeks before the UK release. Forbidden Planet will have the first crack at Sarah Jane and Eccleston's Ninth Doctor with Banana Grip.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah. Yes. So ordered those right away, made sure that those will be sent over to me as fast as they can get them across the pond. And now I'll add the Captain Jack to the list. But when I saw that they were going to be doing a Sarah Jane figure, I was extremely pleased. And I think I waited all of about 5, maybe 6 minutes to find my credit card and start punching my order. So,
yeah.
So you're feeling a little sluggish that day.
I was. Well, I was in the middle of a conference call, so.
Jeez.
Had it open another window.
Yeah, I don't know. I will just get the one, I think. But yeah, no, I've got.
They're both pretty dapper looking. Which one are you going to go with?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. I'd have to get a good look at them. I'm trying to find good images because all I've got right now is the Instagram collage that John Barrowman put out with, you know, both versions in front of his face, both versions on his Dalek, but. He was right. A little excited.
Yeah, his full-scale Dalek that he happens to have in his sunroom. Yeah.
Yeah, once I get a good look at him, I'll decide which one I'm going to go with. But, yeah, I don't know.
I kind of dig the Vortex Manipulator one because he's looking a little more cross, you know, mm-hmm. has the jacket buttoned up and, you know, sort of posing the manipulator in front of him, whereas the other one is just kind of the stare-down Jack.
Yeah. Yeah, but I'm absolutely going to have to add Sarah Jane to the order now. Mm-hmm. And apparently...
Yeah, you won't be able to... They won't actually start... I actually checked through Amazon in the States. most of the redistributors that are planning on carrying it, because you can see them listed already, mm-hmm. but they tell you you're going to have to wait till April to get them. But if you're willing to pay a little more to have them shipped across, you can have them by the first week of February.
Okay, is this a new release as well, or did I just miss it before? But apparently Haley needs to get her credit card out too, because they have River Song.
Listen, there's a lot of Funkos I need in my life.
Let me just lay that out for you right here and now.
It's becoming an issue, let me tell you.
I'm running out of shelf space. I'm going to have to dedicate a third shelf here soon.
You think you're joking?
No, I'm speaking about myself personally.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because between the Funkos and the little Titans, which, by the way, when you put them side by side...
They look weird.
Yeah, you almost wonder if they should be putting the Funko heads on the Titan bodies so everything's like a normal scale.
Cute little Funkos with the big bobbly heads.
I know, but there's times where there have been certain ones, like when I got my X-Files set, and they actually did like a little gray alien to go with the X-Files set. His head is so large, his feet are so small, that I use it to test level on every surface in my house. But
all right.
Yeah. My 12th Doctor, his feet aren't level, so.
Mm. Oh, and as the calendar stands, please note that we are now 1 month away. 1 month away from Galley 1, season 27.
Yay.
So be sure to find us there. It's going to be a busy, busy weekend.
Yeah.
All right. Well,
and we're closing in two months and change to Regeneration Who for all you folks in the Maryland or DC area. And it just goes on and on and on from there. Busy, busy year to be a Whovian, even when there's nothing airing.
Yeah. Well, next week we're... Next week, we're going to take a look at, like we talked about, with Class coming out and revisiting the Ian and Barbara in this episode and seeing some of the old stuff. We want to take a look back at the role that Coal Hill School has played in the history of the show, the different times that it comes up, you know, obviously in the classic with Ian and Barbara, and then again with Clara, and just the different iterations that we've seen of it. So we're going to take a look at that and the role that it's played throughout the history.
I think it's going to be, this is one of those things you talk about, you know, iconic points of the program that are just, that we just come to expect at all times. Coal Hill is something that every time we get an opportunity to return there, whether it's, you know, when we were inside of through the caretaker in recent episodes, or what we've, you know, the news we've had with Class, or anything through human nature, not human nature, I'm sorry, with our school days, that is an institution where I have high hopes with Class. Because this is something where, for anybody that did get interested in, well, how did you possibly have all these kids as representatives of this generation that were exposed to all of these things going on, and yet they still go about their normal lives? How can they possibly go about normal lives with all this paranormal and fantastic stuff going on around them? Maybe they don't. Maybe they have to process it, and they have to, you know, take it all in. So we'll get a chance to look at the full scope of all the oddity that has actually taken place at this one poor institution that's sort of stuck. You'd think that they're like at the Rift, you know, for Torchwood or something, you know, because all this stuff keeps centralizing on this one poor school.
It's
Superintendent Chesterton.
It's just one of those things where it's like they've trained themselves to not notice the weird.
It's the Hellmouth. Oh, I mean, we're going to see a British version of Buffy here.
Oh, joy.
Does that mean the Doctor gets like a cool new umbrella for being the class protector?
We don't talk about the umbrella.
More appearances by Anthony Stewart Head.
Yes.
All right. Well, this has been episode 170 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, you know what, Susan? Maybe go ahead and take half a second longer to check the readouts and make sure there aren't lethal levels of radiation before we walk out the door. Okay.
Nah, you know, just tap the gauge. Just make sure the needle's not stuck. Where would be your sense of adventure?
Were there absolutely no consequences for the lethal radiation?
Nope.
Okay.
Nope, you just got a tan.
All right.
and this is Kier saying, don't keep on looking at me as the weakest link of the party.
And this is Haley saying, the bears will stay warm in their own skin. That burn was better than the fire you can't make.
Well, like the fire you can't make?
We'll see you guys next week.
Bye.
Alan Z.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com. Tell us on Twitter at Gallifrey Radio or on Facebook at facebook.com/Gallifrey Public Radio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows at 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1GPR. You should also go to GunnaGeek.com and check out lots of other high-quality geek-centric shows, or visit forums.GunnaGeek.com to talk about anything geeky with us or the community.
Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2016.
I would give you a chance to burn, but you cannot make fire, so burn!
So, talking about the Funko Pops, I had gotten a Darth Vader Funko, and then for Christmas, I got a Han Solo in his snow gear, and...
Okay. I got that one, too.
Then I got Kylo Ren. So I put them all up there on my shelf, and I wasn't even paying attention, and somebody pointed out, they're like, hey, look, you've got three generations. I was like, oh, now I has a sad.
I don't know. We had tried to get into a discussion the other day with a mutual friend of ours who is so upset that if they try to redeem Kylo Ren in later episode installments, he's completely walking away from the entire franchise because they keep glorifying murderers and child killers.
But it's they're gonna do it. Did you see any of the other movies?
It was like, but that's the pattern that bothers him. He's like, you know, if anybody just has an 11th hour redemption, everything else is forgiven. Nah, you're still remembered as an asshole.
Yeah.
You just happen to go out on a note where you reach for redemption, yeah, whether or not you actually
do. Do you remember Vader as a good guy? Not so much, no.
No. Not since the pod races.
Oh, jeez.
Let's try spinning. That's a good trick.
You're both horrible people.
Although, what was that little creepy-looking sort of drowned like schnauzer thing that he was racing against in the pod races?
What?
Zabulba?
Zabulba, okay. Zabulba has a kind of a ratchety, racked-up face there. He could be a later Smoke.
You mean
or a Snoke?
Snoke.
A Snoke.
Snoke. Oh,
has like the bits of his face hanging down. Could have that kind of look.
Although, that's a bit of a stretch.
They're all a stretch at this point. My favorite meme is the one out there that says Snoke could possibly be Snoke. Look at this photo and this photo. Same Snoke cleft in head. Also goes by the name Snoke. You mean that he could actually be a character named Snoke and not be someone hidden from the, you know, strange, shadowy, inky subwaters of this mythos? Heaven forbid we create a character.
It's just Gollum.
It's just giant Gollum. Giant projection screen Gollum.
I right now I'm still dealing with all of the heartbreak from the Uncle Chewie comics that I've been seeing pop up.
Oh yeah,
all the feels. It's just one of those things. It's like, you know, you're going through and you're just about to get over it, and then somebody's like, "Hey, look at this new angle you hadn't considered." Oh, damn it!
I don't want to overanalyze these stories. I don't think these stories warrant the depth. Look at us, Whovian saying stupid, you know, moron, shut up, Kier. But there is not enough to go on to lay 15 layers of subtext under something that probably only had 2 layers at the initial writing.
Yeah. I can definitely get behind that. I mean, there's some that are some of these things. I'm like, yeah, you're digging a bit too far there. The Uncle Chewy thing, that's a believable thing. I mean, that's part of, you know, that's a feasible stretch. You like, okay, these characters, I understand. It's yeah, that's, but some of this stuff that's just, yeah, they're digging way too far into it. And it's like, really, man, just calm down.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, well, because of the fact that when you've got a fan base that has built such an EU,
mm-hmm.
and then you throw it all away.
they feel the need to fill the void.
Yeah, you've robbed them of their pastime.
So, this is true. Well,
that's where fanfic just explodes. Because you don't have to accept it as canon, or even headcanon at that point. You just say, huh, okay, that was an interesting take. Nice. I like it. I'm going to move on to this other person who's shipping these two people.
I'm just, at this point, I'm just excited and waiting for Rogue One. That's, once I get that, I'll be okay.
What's the calendar on that one again?
It's 2016?
May 2017.
17? I thought it was 16. I thought it was like closer. Hang on.
Wait, it can't be May 2016. When is it?
It's not December May. 2016? Yeah, I think it's December 2016. Because I knew it was like, yeah, December 16th, 2016.
Okay, and then they're moving to May for
episode releases eight, after yes. that.
So May 2017 is when we get. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, come on, okay. we get Alan Tudyk. I mean, you're gonna get Wash in Star Wars. It's come on.
And the Ewoks are gonna throw a spear through his windshield.
Oh,
too soon.
I don't know.
Please just have him behind the chess game that's on the Falcon. You know, you're playing with little figures, mm-hmm. so that he can have a couple little dinosaurs in front of him. Curse your sudden but inevitable betrayal. You cheated in this game.
I'm just, at some point, I want him like flying an X-Wing or something, and he just says, I'm a leaf on the wind. And somebody's like, what was that? Nothing.
No, you know, he stole the Alan Tudyk stole the big red button off of the set of Firefly for it to just be somewhere around him in his cockpit.
No, but he gave it to Joss Whedon, and Joss Whedon is so completely done with Disney right now.
Mm-hmm. Rightfully so.
Nah, I'm not saying it was wrong. Just there's no chance of him coming back to help Disney with anything, I think. Even if it is Star Wars.
He's not going to help Disney. He's not going to help Marvel. He's going to go off and make his own movies. Blackjack and Hookers. And probably Nathan Fillion.
Obviously Nathan Fillion.
As a hooker.
I don't know. I still think one of my favorite things was hearing Nathan Fillion, like when he got the call about doing Serenity. He's like, you know, when you see Joss Whedon's name pop up on your phone, you just answer and say yes. I don't care what it is, just yes.
Mm-hmm. He's like the Mentos of the film industry, the career maker.
All right, well, I need to go get some sleep, so I say we wrap this up.
All right, I'm going to go play with some Legos.
Yay, Legos!
I got a whole bag of them. It's like hand-me-down. Someone's like cleaning out the closet. I'm like, oh, yeah, this big bag of Legos, and that's great. I'm going to boil them in a pot. For about 6 minutes, because I know where your kids have been. So
I mean, doesn't know where the Legos have been.
No, in or around your kids. So I'm gonna go boil them. Did I say 6 minutes? I'm gonna make it 8 minutes.
We're gonna round up to an even 9 minutes.
So I'm just gonna leave the pot going overnight.
Let's just do that. It's not like they're gonna melt together and they're drenched in water. So, so much.
All right, I have to ask: Have you? How much time have you gotten to play on Lego Dimensions?
We are waiting. We're going to get through a little more of the standard stories before we drop in the Back to the Future pack.
Okay.
Because I want to play around with those levels. And I didn't think I was really going to want the Portal pack, but now that I played through that level, that's kind of fun playing Portal in Lego.
Yeah. That's, ironically, those are the two that my kids got for Christmas. They got Back to the Future and Lego and Portal.
So. Yep. I have no interest in the what is their feudal Japan thing? What is that? That not Chimera?
Oh, the one of the Lego, the Spinjitzu or something. That's
yeah, some
Chima, Lego Chima, or they've got Lego Chima, and then they've got another one in there too.
Are you guys still speaking English?
Yeah, I want Indiana Jones, Pirates of the Caribbean. I want all the games, the Lego games that I've been playing up to this point. when they handed this over. So, you know, I got my Marvel superheroes, I got my Doctor Who, I got my this. But those are the play sets that are actually kind of cool just to look at. They're like, wow, you guys put a lot of detail into matching the universe here. I don't want Wizard of Oz.
Yeah, no.
I want Indiana Jones.
Exactly. Give me the ones that I've already spent money on, dang it.
I want to pull a little burning Lego heart out of a little Lego hand chest on the
front of my head. You know, for kids.
Yeah. But in the Lego world, it'll be like he'll pull out like an apricot or something. Or a banana. Oh, like a flaming banana. Like you do.
All right. Let's wrap this up.
Get out of here. Night, kids.
Night. Night.